Before we dive in, I want to take a moment to thank you for being with us here at The World. We are well aware of all the competition for your time and attention, and we are grateful that we are your source for global news. We hope that you find our work clarifying and believe like we do that independent, fact-based journalism is essential for democracy and can help us all gain perspective and make sense out of the noise. We're able to bring you critical reporting on international events because listeners like you support our work. From now until June 14th, we are fundraising with a goal of $25,000. Every gift counts and helps us cover the costs, from reporting trips and keeping our team safe to maintaining audio equipment, all so we can focus on sharing stories from around the world with nuance and with care. We hope you'll consider creating a monthly donation and joining the listeners who help sustain our newsroom year-round. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give, or use the link in the episode notes to contribute. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for being with The World. Now, on to the show.
The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
President Trump is behind on the votes. He's not going away quietly.
Donald Trump has certainly been waging an autocratic attempt, and now he's trying to create a breakthrough by making it impossible to remove him. I think it's likely he will fail this time around.
But has Trump paved the way for a future American autocrat? No matter what happens in the weeks to come, the U.S. and the world will remain deeply polarized. Our guest in Beirut asks,
how do you roll back the rage? How do you bring people in? How do you bring people together? I think that is the question.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, a global trend reaches Delaware and a candidate makes history.
It takes an incredible amount of courage to be a transgender person and be out and running for office.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. An unofficial victory for one of two candidates is near. We won't officially know who will be the next president of the United States until December 14th. That's when members of the Electoral College cast their ballots for president. Today, though, it's looking like the people have chosen Joe Biden. The sounds of celebration in Philadelphia, Biden supporters singing and dancing, re-co-opting a song that has become an anthem on the Trump campaign trail. If it happens, a Biden presidency would not become a reality for 75 days. And if in the meantime President Trump refuses to concede defeat, the transition of power could be especially treacherous. Here to consider what might lie ahead is Nicholas Burns. He's a former U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. He's also an advisor to Vice President Joe Biden's campaign. Nick, I'm really interested in how this moment is seen abroad among allies and adversaries. Biden appears on a path to victory. Trump is digging in his heels. What does this moment mean for U.S. power in the world? Are we momentarily a superpower adrift?
Well, I think we are seen that way by many of our friends around the world, Marco. I sense in my own conversations just with friends around the world over the last 48 hours, a lot of anxiety about America and the moment that we're in, even I would say fear. They've never seen an America in such an unstable state. They've seen the president allege a massive conspiracy to steal the election. They've seen the president declare victory and attempt to stop votes from being counted. And I think our closest friends around the world are shocked that in the citadel of democracy, that's the United States, this kind of direct attack on our democracy and the essence of it, that a vote will be free and fair, it's been made by our own president. I think it's shaken people up. They're worried about buildings being boarded up for fear of violence. People around the world are worried that their previous image of us, that we're a self-confident country, that we're a leader, that we're engaged with them in trying to keep the world peaceful and stable, they don't see that in Donald Trump, and they worry about that. I think a lot of people worried about what the president may do next.
I was rewatching the late Senator John McCain's concession speech in 2008 to Obama, a very distinguished and respectful moment. You've been in the U.S. State Department during presidential transitions from one party to another. What is that typically like? And this time around, how do you think it might be different?
I certainly remember Senator McCain's very gracious speech in 2008. I was actually in the White House working for President George H.W. Bush on the National Security Council staff when he lost to Bill Clinton. He gave a magisterial concession speech talking about the importance of a peaceful transfer of power. He wrote a note to Bill Clinton on Inauguration Day saying, you're our president now, and we're all going to root for you. And so I think the stakes are so high for how we see ourselves, but also for how others see us, because the United States does not want to be seen by our adversaries as weak and unstable.
So, Nick, sketch out the best and worst case scenarios in this upcoming transition.
You know, transitions are tricky. I've been through a number of them. Republican to Democrat, Democrat to Republican, as a nonpartisan official myself, as a Foreign Service officer. Our tradition, of course, the only way to conduct a transition is one president at a time. So President Trump, even if he loses, is going to be our president until noon on January 20th, 2021. And we just have to hope that somehow people around him are going to influence him to act in a civil manner, to act in some way to try to unify the country. Given what we know of him, and we know a lot about him, I think he's not capable of that. And so can others, can Republican Party leaders stand up to say enough, accept the will of the people, accept the votes that have been counted.
Nicholas Burns is a former U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. He's also an advisor to Vice President Joe Biden's campaign. It is great to have you with us today, Nick. Thank you, and have a relaxing weekend.
Thank you very much, Marco.
Last night, when it was looking increasingly likely that Joe Biden would muster enough electoral votes to win the presidency, President Trump spoke at the White House.
If you count the legal votes, I easily win. If you count the illegal votes, they can try to steal the election from us. If you count
lies like that, and on it went for 17 minutes. The president providing no evidence to support his claims that the American election was being stolen from him. Across the landscape, members of the media, pundits, and some Republicans quickly described the speech as a low point for American democracy. Here's CNN's Jake Tapper reacting in the moment.
What a sad night for the United States of America to hear their president say that, to falsely accuse people of trying to steal the election, to try to attack democracy that way with this feast of falsehoods.
The major news network simply pulled the plug on the president and took him off the air. Joining me now is Masha Gessen. In their book, Surviving Autocracy, Gessen chronicles the rise of Trump and the American political trajectory of the past few years. They're also a staff writer with The New Yorker. First of all, Masha, I just want to get reaction from you to Trump's speech last night. What did you make of it?
Perhaps I'm a little different from people who saw it as something really extraordinary. And frankly, I wasn't surprised. I mean, I think that Trump has been telling us that this is exactly what he was going to do. And this is exactly how he perceived the electoral process. And we knew that this is what he was going to do. He was going to cast aspersions in the electoral process. He was going to basically say that whatever votes were cast for him were good votes, beautiful votes, legal votes, and everything else was illegitimate.
Right. So you're obviously not surprised last night when he actually comes out and says this. So let's jump to a different scenario where in the near future, Joe Biden takes office. What lasting effects will 4 years of Trump have on the presidency or on the U.S. government as a whole? Like, what was already baked in that is now even more evident, and what can be undone?
I actually think we need a reinvention, both institutional and spiritual, of democracy. We need to really have a countrywide conversation about what we mean by democracy. Democracy is not elections. Democracy is not a set of institutions. Those are all instruments of democracy. But how do we create a government of the governed? How do we create a government of the people, by the people, and for the people? These are fundamental questions that we haven't asked in a long time. And I think that part of the reason that it has been so easy for Donald Trump to pervert institutions is because we haven't been having this conversation. These are really huge and difficult projects that can be accomplished in Washington through Washington means. They're kind of national conversation types of projects. And that's what we really need to do in order to avoid a Donald Trump or a successor to Trump coming back in to take advantage of the structural changes that he has made.
Masha, in what countries have you seen democracy get reinvented while kind of the bus, as it were, is still moving? Where has that worked? Is there a model to follow?
You know, at the moment, it's looking pretty bleak. But I think that democratic experiments are often not terribly long-lasting because they require reinvention all the time. But, for example, Poland has had an amazing 30-year run where a totalitarian regime gave way to something that was really beautiful and representative and thriving for a long, long time. Americans tend to think of democracy as something you build and then inhabit. And I think that, the tendency to think that way has actually been more pronounced sort of over the last generation, as we refer back to the founding fathers as though they invented everything once and for all. But democracy is not that. Democracy is a process of constant reinvention.
Masha Gessen is the author of Surviving Autocracy, where they chronicle the rise of Donald Trump. Masha, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It took a few days of counting to get to where we are in the presidential race, but the results in another contest came in right away on election night itself. Sarah McBride easily won her race in Delaware, and with that win, McBride becomes the first openly transgender person elected to any state senate in the U.S. As the world's Bianca Hillier reports, her victory follows a global trend.
With Sarah McBride's historic win came international attention.
America riyasat Delaware se Democrat umidwar Sarah McBride
apni Sarah McBride yes sin duda
America lo LGBTQ hakula udyamakarani pramukha nyayavadi Sarah McBride.
McBride, a fierce LGBTQ advocate who interned at the White House during the Obama years, is now the highest-ranking transgender elected official in America.
First off, I just want to start with a couple of thank yous.
In a post-win speech at a restaurant next to a busy road, she had a message for queer youth.
That our democracy is big enough for them, too. That their voices matter. And that change is always possible.
Listening in to those remarks from New Zealand was Labour MP Louisa Wall. She's a trailblazing LGBTQ advocate who led her country's campaign to legalize same-sex marriage.
I'm so incredibly proud of Sarah McBride in Delaware. I'm beaming for her. It's a wonderful achievement.
An achievement that Wall knows isn't happening in isolation. In the U.S. alone, the number of out LGBTQ elected officials has doubled in the past 4 years. This week, queer candidates from coast to coast added to those gains.
Hi, I'm Marie Turner. My pronouns are she and they.
Is Democrat Richie Torres.
My name is Michelle Rayner Coolsby.
I'm State Representative Chevron Jones.
And Jabari Brisport.
I'm Mondaire Jones.
Taylor Small here.
My name is Kim Jackson, and I'm running for Senate District 41.
They all won. New Zealand's Louisa Wall says,
these are significant things. And it's not a domain anymore just for white men. And I'll just cut to the chase because that has historically been who gets to govern us around the world.
Not anymore. Last month, Wall herself was part of history when New Zealand's parliament broke a record.
New Zealand is the most rainbow, gayest, queerest parliament in the world. So I'm really proud to be a Kiwi.
About 10% of the Kiwi parliament is now openly LGBTQ. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern also brought Grant Robertson on as her right-hand man. He's the first openly gay man to ever serve as deputy prime minister. Louisa Wall says these gains being made in New Zealand are a step in the right direction for everyone.
The more of us there are around the world, the greater our voice will be to ensure as a first principle we have global homosexual law reform. We're fighting for intersex rights, for trans rights, to end conversion therapy, you know, social and health services, for affirmation surgery. Those challenges are about being full citizens.
In strong agreement with that is Ruben Gonzalez.
I feel really good.
Gonzalez is vice president of the LGBTQ Victory Institute, based here in the U.S. It's an organization helping queer and trans leaders get elected around the world. He's seen this international snowball effect taking place firsthand.
We've been able to take our lessons from United States candidates that have been successful and apply those to teach how to run for office more effectively as an out trans person or as an out gender non-binary person in places like Latin America, the Caribbean, South Africa, and other places that we're working. And we have seen some success there as well.
For example, he said, last year, the city of Bogota elected Claudia Lopez as mayor. She's the first woman and the first openly gay person to lead the city.
Hoy por fin ganamos!
The queer community also saw a watershed moment in Belgium last month when the country elected Petra de Sitter, a transgender woman, as their deputy prime minister. She's now the highest-ranking transgender leader in the world. Notably, de Sitter's gender identity was hardly mentioned in Europe's post-election headlines, which LGBTQ advocates are taking as a win. De Sitter tweeted, I'm proud that in Belgium and in most of Europe, your gender identity does not define you as a person and is a non-issue. I hope that my appointment as minister and deputy PM can trigger the debate in countries where this is not yet the case. Ruben Gonzalez says she's absolutely right. The realities of running for office as a queer candidate are very different in different countries. Gonzalez says the attacks over the past year on trans candidates were more frequent and uglier than ever before. But no matter where these politicians are based, there is a shared experience among them as candidates.
This common thread of courage. You know, it takes an incredible amount of courage to be a transgender person and be out and running for office, especially in a place where the government and the police may not protect your physical safety while you're running for office.
For that matter, Gonzalez says connecting queer politicians around the world is a vital step for getting more LGBTQ people on the ballot. As Sarah McBride in Delaware says, their dreams and identities are not mutually exclusive. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. No matter what happens in the next few weeks, the Trump presidency has changed a lot about our society, and there may be no going back. So says Kim Gattas, a writer and fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Gattas is from Beirut, and she sees a lot of similarities between the Middle East and the U.S. right now.
After President Trump came to the White House, he brought with him instantly the kind of uncertainty and these unsettled feelings about what tomorrow brings that I mostly associate with the Middle East. And I remember even before President Trump was elected, there was around me, you know, friends in Washington and New York were starting to feel the sort of same uncertainty. The idea that in America, an election could change the direction of the country to this extent was something that they never experienced before.
Much of your work, Kim, has been in the Middle East. You've seen how societies can unravel, rising extremism, cultural intolerance, bigotry. What parallels do you see between the Middle East's recent history and, say, the last couple of years in the U.S. under the Trump presidency?
The comparisons are not perfect, but what I have seen is a slow erosion of freedoms in the U.S., a shifting of norms and values. This sense on both sides of the political divide that the other is a threat to you and your tribe, an existential threat. And shifts like this happen sometimes over a long time and sometimes very quickly. President Trump, he was not an aberration. This week's election makes that clear. He got 70 million votes. And so President Trump was a manifestation of trends that had been there. But his time in power has accelerated and inflated a lot of these trends. And he has fed the ego of white nationalists and supremacists.
As the U.S. presidential race has heated up over the past year and the lines of division have become more stark, specifically, what recent headlines here in the U.S. have reverberated for you from your perch in Beirut and why?
But waking up in Beirut to headlines about the middle class in America being killed by the pandemic, juxtaposed with a piece about the middle class in Lebanon dying, headlines about armed men with no insignia in Portland, Oregon, picking people off the street. I mean, that's the kind of stuff we deal with in countries like Lebanon and Iraq. Senator Tom Cotton saying, you know, send in the military to quell the demonstrations. I mean, that is rhetoric that rulers in the Middle East use. So there's sort of this mirroring, these echoes that are really quite interesting.
I mean, some of the similarities as you map them out there are uncanny. Based on what you've seen in Beirut, Kim, what does all that tell you about the future here in the U.S.?
What people have held on to in the U.S. is this faith in their institutions. And we've seen that institutions can be corrupted, even in the U.S., and that institutions are only as good as the societies that feed them and support them. So although America's hasn't turned into the Middle East overnight, there are trends that are worrying and that can be rolled back with a new president. What we can learn from the Middle East is the importance to, first of all, acknowledge these trends and acknowledge that they don't end simply because there's a new president in the U.S.
As I think about changes in the last 3 years, there are the big ones like the Paris Climate Agreement. The U.S. is out because of Trump. Trump also pulled the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal. But what about smaller, subtle changes? Like, give us a comparison with Lebanon. What subtle changes in Lebanon stuck over the years and suggest that if there was a normal there at some point in history, it was not going to happen again?
the ability to accept the other's point of view has slowly been eroded. It can be religion, but it can be other dogma. And that's some of what we're seeing unfold in the US as well. This absolutist position that I am right and you are wrong, and I'm willing to use violence to eliminate you.
How can fanaticism be dialed back? Have you seen hopeful signs of that in the Mideast?
I think it really requires holding on to that center and trying to expand it. You know, in Lebanon, I think we've lost a lot, but we've managed to maintain a lot. And we do still have a strong center. We are still able to meet. I think there's a lot of thinking that needs to be done on that for the Middle East and for the US. How do you roll back the rage? How do you bring people in? How do you bring people together? I think that is the question that the world is facing today, not just in the US and Lebanon, but beyond as well.
During this stressful election, I think a lot of us feel that the country is a different place than we thought it was, certainly feeling that since 2016. You've pointed to the late Anthony Bourdain, who fell in love with Beirut, and his view that Beirut shows how deeply troubled and at the same time how beautiful and awesome the world can be. That is a gray zone, though, and that gray duality may be hard to accept for some people. What is the Beirut formula for looking at a future full of so much uncertainty? Give us your pro tip, Kim.
Take it day by day. Take it day by day and build a community around you and listen to the other. You know, America is a lot about black and white, about it works or it doesn't work. Every problem has a solution. The world is not like that, and neither is America. The world is full of uncertainty, especially these days. Sometimes the gray areas are uncomfortable, but when you acknowledge them, you can find your way forward. I think that in many ways, this is Lebanon's strength. It is also, unfortunately, sometimes it's undoing. Too many compromises can be bad for you. If we had the formula in Lebanon, we'd be a perfect country, but we're certainly not. I think that what we still have is this incredible ability to constantly renew ourselves, to constantly find the way forward, and to deal with adversity, not just with resilience, but with courage and empathy. This constant ability to reach out to the other and to build community around you is what keeps us going.
Kim Gatas is a writer and a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Her essay in The Atlantic is America's Future Might Be Lebanon. Kim joined us from Beirut. Thank you so much for your thoughts and your time, Kim. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Marco.
Since Tuesday, the week has felt like someone else set cruise control, and there's nothing we can do to slow it down or speed it up. You know what I mean. That's not my idea of cruising. This is. This is Raul Pacheco, the guitarist from Ozo Motley, one of my favorite Latin jam bands. He's on a solo outing here with this new single, an ode to his neighborhood in Los Angeles, Boyle Heights. It's called Cruisin' Song.
Traveled around the world, collecting wisdom pearls, experience. Strangers witness pride.
Yeah, it is Friday, and it has been a week. Trust me, there's more to the story. Take a breath and head over to our website for that necessary global context for this head-spinning election. That's all at theworld.org/2020election. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. On election night ago, Americans crashed Canada's immigration website. Some actually moved north. 4 years later, with Biden on the cusp, what are they thinking now?
I'm still an American, and this was the most important election of my lifetime.
That was 2016. Could it be time to come back home? That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. With everything going on this week, gotta remember, we're still in a pandemic, one that is getting worse by the day. Infections are surging to record levels here in the U.S. and throughout Europe. This week, many European nations imposed new restrictions as hospitals prepare for a surge in people needing treatment. The World's Ilana Gordon has been looking at the pros and cons of lockdowns. So besides a lockdown being the thing that everyone wants to avoid and the thing at the center of so many heated debates, Ilana, it's also a really broad concept.
Lockdowns, what's so interesting when you look around the world, they really vary, like in how stringent they are. But there's an underlying concept to it all that's somewhat universal. They are meant to stop the spread of infections, to stop rising deaths and overwhelming hospitals by limiting people's contacts with each other. Once you hit this certain point of infection spreading, it's really hard to spot outbreaks and control them. I can't get this image out of my mind, Marco, from Thomas Hale. He's a researcher at Oxford, about how he views lockdowns.
You know, locking down society to prevent infection is kind of like cutting off a limb to prevent it from infecting the rest of your body. It's maybe the right choice if you're really in a desperate situation, but it's a pretty costly one, and one you probably can't repeat too many times without some lasting damage.
So, obviously, we don't want to cut off more limbs. That sounds really drastic, though. So, if we're looking globally, where have lockdowns succeeded?
So, researchers like Hale are just trying to begin to understand this. He's been monitoring, like, the stringency, the level of restrictions and lockdowns around the world. And it's super preliminary, but what he's been finding is that the lower level of the government stringencies and restrictions and the slower response times for putting in those lockdowns, that was associated with more deaths from COVID-19. But again, these approaches actually need to be studied more. And here's the thing about lockdowns. It's not the end goal. Here's Hale.
Lockdowns are not a solution. Lockdowns are a way to buy time to try to build up capacity to manage the virus going forward.
It's about using that time to ramp up these non-lockdown containment strategies like testing and communicating with the public.
So as new places enter new lockdowns or consider them again, what else has been learned?
I think one area that some public health researchers I spoke to say isn't getting enough attention is the whole issue of human rights, about enforcement of these policies, and like especially the challenges in lower-income communities and countries where people just don't have this luxury of isolating or the resources or supports. And some observational research from Hale's group, again, has found that lockdowns don't actually work in these environments very well. People still are in close contact, but that when governments offer economic support, that's really helped.
Are there any countries that have avoided lockdowns altogether?
Well, some countries have been avoiding a second one, but there's actually a country that never did a full lockdown because legally the government there can't impose those kinds of rules. And that place, Marco, is Japan. I talked with Hitoshi Oshitani. He's a virologist there and a key advisor to the government on its approach to the pandemic.
We knew that we could not do what China was doing. And we also knew that we could not do what Singapore was doing. So we have to find alternative way.
So what happened? Did Japan experience a massive outbreak?
Oshitani is cautious. They've had some outbreaks, like from nightclubs. But overall, Japan hasn't experienced massive outbreaks. They've had less than 20,000 cases, less than 1,000 deaths. And there's an interesting approach there. Early on, they identified a weakness in the virus, which is that the majority of people, Marco, don't infect anyone else. It's just like this small handful of people that cause clusters of super spreading events. And so what they've been doing there is really focusing on preventing these clusters from colliding that create these kind of uncontrolled outbreaks. And you do that through backward tracking or cluster busting.
So is that approach something that other countries could employ?
There is a lot that countries can learn from one another, and as Hale cautions, you know, avoiding losing another limb.
The World's Ilana Gordon, thank you so much.
Thanks, Marco.
5 years ago, voters in Myanmar were ecstatic. An election had just ended decades of totalitarian military rule. The big winner in that election was Aung San Suu Kyi, the former political prisoner, and at the time, global icon for democracy and human rights. Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, holds another election on Sunday, but the government is fighting insurgencies in the mountains and on the coast. The army has tried to violently purge indigenous groups, most recently the Rohingya. Aung San Suu Kyi, whose party is favored to win the election, has defended that purge, appalling many of her fans overseas. So where is Myanmar headed now? We're going to hear from Tant Minh U, a historian and author of The Hidden History of Burma, Race, Capitalism, and Crisis in the 21st Century. He spoke with the World Southeast Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen.
Tant Minh U, thank you so much for speaking to us. Myanmar is having an election this Sunday during a pandemic, and in certain parts of the country where there are insurgencies, people won't even be able to vote. So that's not ideal, but given Myanmar's history, do you think it's remarkable that the country is even having an election?
We have to remember this is a country that was under military dictatorship since 1962, and as recently as 10 or 12 years ago, it was still under a pure military dictatorship, and very few people could have imagined that elections or anything even close to free and fair elections would have been held, much less elections in which Aung San Suu Kyi, who was then a political prisoner, would be able to contest and win. So in that way, the country has made tremendous progress. It is much freer despite many problems than it has been in generations. So despite all the problems, I think the country did move in the right direction. Whether it continues to do that or be able to face all of these incredibly complex challenges, especially around ethnicity and ethnic conflict, I think that remains to be seen.
Outside the country, after the military violently purged this Muslim minority group, the Rohingya, Aung San Suu Kyi got a ton of grief, and the narrative went from she's an angel to she won't stand up to army genocide. But if she had done what all the Western diplomats wanted and stood up for the Rohingya, which wasn't a terribly popular position inside the country, might she be on shakier ground in this election?
She might be on slightly shakier ground in the sense that there are people who feel extremely strongly on this issue in a kind of extremist way. She might have lost some support from those quarters, but I think the vast majority of Burmese people, for them, this is not a priority issue. I mean, we have to remember this is a country of, you know, tens of millions of extremely poor people who suffered from very little education, nothing in the way of government services, who are struggling to get by day to day. And what happens with the Rohingya are in that part of the country, which is really a small corner of the country on the border of Bangladesh, is not the basis on which they're going to vote for her or for someone else.
And her reputation among her supporters, I mean, she is still very well loved. What binds them to her?
They see her first and foremost still as the heroine of the democracy story, as the person who helped to lead the country out of military dictatorship into a future that they hope will be better. I think it's not even so much about how much better that future is or what specific policy she's undertaking. It's about her as a person, as the first leader that they believe they trust.
Myanmar is such a diverse country, and in big parts of the country, especially near the borders, there are indigenous armies fighting the central government for control. And then in some places, the indigenous armies are in control, running their own little governments. These conflicts, they seem to boil down to race and power. I'm wondering if you see racial division as the fundamental problem in Myanmar.
I don't think it's the fundamental problem, but it's one of a few fundamental problems. I mean, on the one hand, you have this story that began, you know, World War II and independence in 1948, where Burma became independent, but then the Burmese-speaking Buddhist majority suddenly kind of found out that they were in a country with many minority peoples, especially up in the uplands towards China and towards India, and that these were people who had very different histories and had really never been part of a Burmese kingdom. And so this effort to kind of bring these other people into or integrate them or forcefully integrate them into a single Burmese nation, I think has been basically a failure since 1948, and there are many people in many local communities who still resist. But the other story is that the Burmese themselves believe they are an indigenous people under threat, because when they look at the map, they see themselves as a small people next to 1.5 billion people in China and 1.5 billion people in the Indian subcontinent, and that they are in threat. And so they need to kind of integrate these others. And that has been a big problem with Burmese politics, especially when it's then spilled over into armed conflict, which it has on and off since 1948.
Myanmar is right next door to China, rising China, with a very strong interest in your country. What does China want from Myanmar?
I think what China wants first and foremost is to prevent what they saw as a kind of nightmare scenario developing about 5 or 6 years ago, where there was a Myanmar which was still fractured, but which was suddenly embraced by the West and was embracing the West in turn. And then there was a real possibility that Western governments, the United States in particular, would not only have a great relationship with the Myanmar government, but would even have relationships with ethnic armed organizations, these insurgent groups that we'd been talking about, right up on the Chinese border. So I think their number one goal is to prevent that. I think beyond that, I think their feeling is that Burma or Myanmar is likely to be a country that's going to be in some kind of conflict for a long time. And they want to be the sort of big brother to all of the different armed groups, both the army itself and these other ethnic armed organizations, so that they can make sure that the fighting doesn't spill over into China or affect China in a negative way.
Do you sometimes see that the West still exoticizes Myanmar or projects fantasies on what they want it to be instead of looking at it as it is?
I think that's always been the tendency, right? Because it's a country that very few people know. It's a country that was isolated for decades. It wasn't a country like, you know, Thailand or Singapore or Vietnam, to which millions of Americans had been in and had contact and experience in the country. So I think the complexity of the country is often completely lost. But I don't think anyone romanticizes it now. I think after the Rohingya violence of 2017 in particular, I think people are kind of unsure how to think about this country and how these different kind of stories are meant to connect to one another. And I think there's enormous concern about the plight of the Rohingya in particular. I think unless people start to delve into the complexity of the country, there's no way that the outside world can even begin to think about helping Burma, which is going to be a country that's going to need a lot of help, I think, in the years to come.
That's Tant Minh U, a historian and author of The Hidden History of Burma, Race, Capitalism, and Crisis in the 21st Century. He was speaking with The World's Patrick Nguyen. Election Day in Myanmar is this Sunday. The little country of Denmark, population less than 6 million, is the biggest producer of mink fur in the world. But now Danish fur farmers are worried about going out of business forever. They're facing a government order to exterminate 15 million minks to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Tom Carstensen has this report from Copenhagen.
The Danish government has made its decision. All of the country's minks must be put down. The Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, said so on a press conference held on Wednesday. The press conference was held in an unusual way. All the ministers and public health officials were not physically in the room, but talking to journalists via screens. This is because a number of Danish politicians have caught COVID-19 and are in isolation. Most mink farms are in the north of the country. After the latest outbreak there, people were told to stay within the borders of their local towns. All pubs, cafes, restaurants and sporting events in the region were shut down. Danish authorities say that mink are now considered a public health risk. The authorities Friday raised the confirmed number infected with the mutated strain of coronavirus to 214 from 12. Of them, 14 are outside the area under extra lockdown. A National Health Agency Statens Serum Institute conducted the tests on the animals suspected of spreading the disease.
Worst case scenario here, det er at vi har en pandemi der starter forfra igen med udgang.
Director Kåre Mølbak told reporters that the worst case scenario is a whole new pandemic in Denmark.
Det er ekstremt alvorligt. Så det betyder at den immunitet man får enten.
If these mutations got out of hand, Mølbak said, there's a risk of compromising people's immunity.
At vi mister den og så på den måde skal starte helt forfra, fordi vi har.
Mølbak said mutations in the coronavirus could also make future COVID-19 vaccines useless, or at the very least be a major setback. The decision to kill off all 15 million minks in the country will be devastating to the Danish fur industry, farmers say. Mink furs add up to about 4% of all Danish agricultural exports.
Jamen, det er forfærdeligt.
Mink farmer John Papsui says he's devastated. He's been ordered to cull his entire stock of 30,000 animals in 10 days' time.
Vi er vel sådan mere eller mindre i total granatchok, hvor.
It's horrible, he says, and he doesn't know what it will mean for his livelihood.
Og så videre, så det er mere eller mindre sådan en choktilstand.
Papsui says he and his wife have been running the farm for 30 years. He's also an organizer for people in the industry.
Så kommer de med politi eller militær, og gør det.
If we don't carry out the call, he says, the government will send the police or even military. I'd say it's 99% certain the industry will not come back from this, Papsui says. Danish mink farmers get about 35 to 40% more for their fur than most other countries' farmers because it's better quality. That stems from the breeding stock, and when they're gone, it's all gone.
Fra i dag skal hele Nordjylland gabe op, for sundhedsmyndighederne opfordrer alle 200...
It's not just the farmers who are scratching their heads about this decision. Some health experts in Europe have questioned the thinking here, saying the coronavirus mutations discovered in northern Denmark are not fully understood. Thomas Benfield is a scientist clinician and one of the key physicians in the fight against COVID-19 in Denmark. At first, he says he was skeptical about the decision to cull so many minks.
But I've learned that we have really many mink in Denmark being farmed, and that the epidemic spreads extremely quickly among mink in each farm.
After looking at the latest data, Benfield says that the risk of virus jumping between animals and humans is not to be underestimated.
The past 6 months has proven that the risk is there, and it is pretty high, because it appears that the SARS coronavirus, it's possible for it to infect humans and mink. And we've already seen a lot of cross-transmission between mink and humans.
But there's one group of people that's very supportive of the culling. That's animal rights activists. They see this as a unique opportunity to finally put an end to an industry they have long criticized for being inhumane. For The World, Tom Carstensen, Copenhagen.
If you find yourself looking at your smartphone every 20 seconds to get the latest on the vote count, or trying to quickly relearn what you were taught in your high school government class, you're far from alone. Political cartoonists are doing a bang-up job helping us make sense of the moment, especially cartoonists outside the United States. Many pen and ink reactions this week are universal. The drawings ask, what exactly is going on in America right now? Consider one cartoon from South Africa. Trump is threatening to cut Lady Liberty's neck if he doesn't get the votes. Others reflect the collective global gasp that a nearly 250-year-old democracy is struggling. You can check out our sampling of cartoons from Europe, Asia, Africa, and Latin America at our website. We're at theworld.org. Also at the Twitter feed, at Global Cartoons. A lot of us remember election night in November 2016. For Trump supporters, of course, it was an unexpected triumph, a time to celebrate. For others, a night of shock and despair. Thousands of Americans that night went online to ask, how do I move to Canada? They actually crashed Canada's immigration website. Some of those would-be immigrants actually followed through and moved up north. As Anita Elash reports from Toronto, they've been watching this year's election story unfold with a unique strain of anxiety.
Stephen Shainbart had never been to Toronto, but on the night Donald Trump was elected president, he decided to move here.
And I was very concerned for the future of my safety and the future of the United States, and I thought it was a very dangerous thing.
Shainbart, a native New Yorker, says he called an immigration lawyer the next day. 3 years later, he became a permanent resident of Canada and settled into his home in downtown Toronto.
Generally, people are kinder to each other as strangers than they are in the U.S., and that's very pleasant.
Melanie Gardner and her husband made their decision to move to Ottawa from the state of Maryland a few months after the 2016 vote.
I was hysterical for weeks. It completely turned my world upside down.
Gardner says she had never considered moving to Canada before then, even though her husband is Canadian. But Trump's victory fundamentally changed the way she sees America. Both Gardner and her husband were retired, so they decided it was time to flee.
It no longer felt like my country, the country I grew up in. It was hostile. The red hats were scary. I was afraid. There are too many guns. It just felt like a foreign place.
Canada's Immigration Department says it's seen a boost in applications from the U.S. In each of the first 3 years of Trump's tenure, nearly 2,000 additional Americans applied for permanent residency here. About two-thirds of those applications were approved, but there's no way to know for sure how many of them were directly related to the rise of Trump. Erica Peterson left San Jose, California for Ottawa in 2018.
While the state of politics wasn't why we left, it made it a lot easier.
Peterson says she and her partner were feeling torn about making the move north for a new job. Then came the school shooting in Parkland, Florida. And Peterson says she was disgusted by Trump's refusal to put stricter gun controls in place.
It kind of felt hopeless. And as far as the perspective of being a mom, you know, I'm seeing the reality of like, oh yeah, kids that go to school these days, they have to have active shooter drills all the time, and like just not wanting to subject my daughter to that worry.
Peterson says she feels safe in Canada and plans to stay, but she's worried that the legacy of Donald Trump, no matter who ends up in the White House next January, will be the damage he's caused to American democracy.
It feels like this election could be the end of the United States as it has been understood.
Peterson tells me she voted by absentee ballot last month for Joe Biden in her former state. Melanie Gardner says she also voted for Biden and that she spent hours as a telephone volunteer encouraging U.S. expats to vote. Stephen Shainbart says he's actually been more politically active during this campaign from his home in Canada than he's ever been.
I'm still an American, and this was the most important election of my lifetime.
When we talked, it looked like Biden was on track to win the election. Shainbart says that gives him comfort. But is it enough for him to think about moving back to New York?
Trump is as much of a symptom of a problem with the United States as he is a cause of problems in the United States.
Shainbart says Trump and his policies are still very popular with many Americans. And that's enough for him to stay put in Canada. For The World, I'm Anita Elash. In Toronto.
Speaking of Canada, there's a phrase that's been trending on Twitter this week, emotional support Canadians. Our friends up north are offering up their services in this hour of need. The World's Sarah Birnbaum gave it a try and placed a call.
Mr. Hansen, please, long distance calling. I'm sorry, the line is busy.
On election night, a lone Canadian tweeted, "Dear America, emotional support Canadians are on standby. If you have not yet received your emotional support Canadian, one will be assigned to you shortly." Operators standing by. Thousands of Americans expressed interest and they demanded emotional support Canadians, like now.
Dear customers, the waiting time may be longer than usual. We apologize for the wait and thank you for your patience.
Some Americans even requested specific support Canadians, like Ryan Gosling.
So it's not going to be easy. It's going to be really hard.
That's from the movie The Notebook, but it's like he's talking right to America.
What do you want?
It's not that simple.
What do you want?
What do I want? I want to call my own emotional support Canadian, my bestie Christine Lee, up in Toronto.
You know, this is a time where people have to get together, trust that the system will work, unite again. You're the United States, for God's sake.
You honestly have trust in the institutions?
I mean, you have a strong democracy, and you've got to keep it strong.
Do you honestly believe that? Because you're an optimist.
I am an optimist. And, you know, where Canadians diverged from Americans is that we believed in government. We believed in paying our taxes.
This is supposed to be support. If you had been better at paying your taxes, actually cared for each other, you wouldn't be in this mess to begin with. This is like the guilt trip like I get from my grandmother.
I mean, the world looks to the United States for its ability to get itself together. So yeah, we believe in you. You got to get it together.
Isn't she a great emotional support Canadian? I'll probably be calling her a lot in the next few months. Besides, I'm pretty sure Ryan Gosling is taken. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
I know we've made mistakes, but we can fix them now. And all the pain you face, we can forgive somehow.
That's the group This Mad Desire from Hamilton, Ontario. Maybe they do Canadian emotional support gigs, too. I think it's fair to say we've all felt it this week. The past 4 days have been exhausting. The most intense and consequential election of our lifetime, certainly of mine, and falling in the middle of a pandemic, while people everywhere are clamoring for social justice. But you are here, you made it to Friday, congratulations. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, leaving you with a little Rodrigo and Gabriella for the weekend. Thank you for being with us. We'll pick it up all again on Monday. Before we go, just a quick reminder that now through June 14th, we are asking listeners to support our work. Your generosity helps power our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting with nuance and with care. Help us reach our goal of $25,000 by making a gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much. From PRX.